Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Moscow today for talks with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The meeting comes as tensions between the United States and Russia reach new heights after the Trump administration launched cruise missile attacks on Syria last week, and Trump shifts to a more traditional neoconservative approach. So much for the supposed Trump-Russia relationship. The new Cold War is back on. We are joined today for the full hour from Moscow by Peter Lavelle, host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk, and from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Peter and Alexander.
Good to be back with you.
Hello.
Thank you for joining. Peter Lavelle, you're there. You're in Moscow. Rex Tillerson arrived in Moscow yesterday. He's due to meet with his counterpart Lavrov today. How different will the atmosphere be compared to the expectations of the meeting, say, 10 days ago before the U.S. airstrikes in Syria?
Well, it went from a possible, maybe, hopefully, a thawing of relations to how are the two ministers going to say, how can we express low expectations without showing it to be a complete catastrophe? This is really bad optics right now. But considering what Secretary Tillerson had to say, meeting the G7, basically drawing this really, really old school line in the sand saying either you're with us or you're with them, meaning either you join Western institutions as presumably a junior partner, or you can stay with BRICS, you can stay with China, you can stay with Iran, you can stay with Syria. The lack of finesse coming out of the State Department, and I will throw in the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations with that, it's just simply appalling. This is not going to be a good meeting. Let's see if they can manage through some kind of protocol to avoid a complete catastrophe.
Alexander, it was very undiplomatic talk for a diplomat. Tillerson told CBS on Sunday whether Russia was complicit here or whether they were simply incompetent or whether they got outwitted by the Bashar al-Assad regime. You would have to ask the Russians that question, but clearly they have failed in their commitment to the international community. That's not very diplomatic.
It's not diplomatic at all. But in a sense, of course, Mr. Tillerson really had no alternative but to say that, because the United States launched this missile attack without any proper investigation being conducted. They rushed out an allegation that President Assad was guilty. So in a way, they now have to blame the Russians in order to make their own story fit together. And that, of course, illustrates the folly, in a way, of what was done, because it's very difficult now to see how the U.S. can row back on what it has said. And it's going to find it very difficult, I think, for Mr. Tillerson, when he goes to Moscow, to conduct any kind of intelligent conversation with Mr. Lavrov. Besides which, one has to wonder how much influence Mr. Tillerson indeed even has in Washington, given that these decisions are made so quickly and without, it seems, much consultation at all.
Peter Lavelle, same question to you.
I'd like to kind of follow up on what Alex said here. What's really interesting is a number of things. First of all, there's been no strategy announced in how to deal with the Syrian crisis. We have to remind our listeners that there were a number of moments in the recent past where there was some kind of coming together. There was some kind of meeting of minds, ceasefires, deflecting agreements. I mean, there was a movement, there was a momentum, the liberation of Aleppo, the turning of the tide. There was an ample opportunity for this to happen. But when President Bush came out on the White House lawn, and I was appalled, to be honest with you, a journalist almost actually coached him into saying things that I don't think he really was aware of the implications. He said, I am now responsible for Syria. When he said that, he dramatically reduced his options. I mean, it's really astounding And we all want to see the end of this conflict here. But when you have all of this rhetoric coming out, Nikki Haley, she should be relieved of her job immediately. The damage every time she opens her mouth. Because the Russian side, if you agree with Russia's position vis-a-vis Syria or not, Russians are very seasoned diplomats. And they have to parse all of these things coming out of many different power vectors in Washington. And how can you sit down and negotiate and have some kind of understanding when it's our way or the highway? President Trump has limited his options. And when he said, I am now responsible for Syria, guess what? He made it Trump's war.
Indeed, Alexander. You know, Nikki Haley made the comment, well, President Trump isn't calling me up and telling me to stop beating up on Russia. So I keep beating up on Russia. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's almost verbatim what she said. Who's running the ship?
Well, this is, I think, a very good question, because it seems to me that nobody is. We have Nikki Haley running what looks to me, frankly, like an election campaign from the Security Council. She's a politician who was once thought of as a potential vice presidential candidate, and clearly she's sees her job as a staging post in her career. We have Mr. Tillerson saying quite different things. We have General McMaster trying to reconcile them, and President Trump himself has all but disappeared. We have hardly heard from him over the last couple of days. So I don't get the impression of any real strategy, as Peter was saying, or indeed any kind of real thinking going on at all. And when one has this situation, it is actually in some ways even more dangerous when there is a policy which one doesn't agree with, because it becomes so difficult to predict what's going to happen from one day to the other if Mr. Tillerson comes to Moscow and comes to some kind of agreement on something with Mr. Lavrov. Who's to say that tomorrow the president or his advisers or the people who are advising him will force him to take a completely different view? So I don't get the impression of any coherence here, and I don't really get the impression of anybody in charge.
I want to come back to the internal dynamics within the Trump administration, but Peter, I want to also talk about what actually happened right before Tillerson arrived in Moscow, which was the meeting of the G7. Certainly the British were hoping for, and I believe the Americans were hoping for, an announcement of new sanctions against Russia by the G7. Italy was the chair of that session. They didn't want sanctions. Germany didn't want sanctions. France didn't want to have sanctions. So there was not even a mention of sanctions. So Tillerson comes to Moscow. I think he was hoping to have a new, I'm representing the West, I'm representing the G7, a united front against Russia. But that didn't happen.
Again, it wasn't thought out. It wasn't thought out. Americans, the American political elite, the establishment, they have no idea about the friction between Europe and Russia about these sanctions that were obviously, and everyone knows, was the forced upon the Europeans by the United States. The United States isn't impacted one iota about these sanctions, but Europe is. My travels to Europe over the last year and a half, when I talk to journalists and politicians and business people, particularly business people, they are furious. They are furious that they have to pay the price. And we all know that the economies in Europe are struggling, the politics of austerity, particularly in Germany in the industrial sectors. Last time I was in Austria, they have a very strong dairy sector. They are livid that, you know, why do they have to pay this cost? When they said Crimea is Russian. Okay, that's a different story here. But Tillerson, you know, we always have to give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, when they hit the ground, not everyone's going to be running. That's okay with me. I'm not going to be overcritical. But when we get to these very important points that could be of crisis, and I think we're there right now, you know, where is the expertise? Tillerson thought it was going to be a cakewalk. One has to wonder, is he aware of what sanctions mean to the Europeans vis-a-vis the situation with Russia? So this is a very steep learning curve. And I think all of us would say, in all fairness, that, you know, Donald Trump needs a lot of help when it comes to foreign policy. He's not a very nuanced man, and he's not getting that. And I want to back up with something that Alexander had to say, is that when we look at what's going on here, this dynamic explained, ever since the decision to launch missile strikes against Syria, where is the intelligence community? Where are they? What are they saying? What is Pompeo saying? Nothing has been said. Again, there are so many missing things here for us to try to coherently understand what's going on.
Indeed, it is a defining moment, though. The American government has not offered proof. We haven't heard from the intelligence agencies. Nobody's coming forward except to say there's a high degree of confidence. The Russians have said, let there be an investigation. Let the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons investigate. And they say they will. But, of course, Idlib is completely controlled by Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda affiliates, whatever their name is. But this was a defining moment, Alexander, too, because suddenly Trump's critics in Washington were muted. In fact, not only muted, they saluted Trump. They've been against Trump from day one and before day one. I'm talking about on CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, which hated Trump. They were saluting Trump. Finally, unity has been achieved again within the summits of the American political establishment based on bombing another Arab country without evidence that they use chemical weapons or weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it really says so much about what makes Washington tick. Go ahead.
Well, it is, I think, actually very terrifying because it seems that the U.S. cannot reconcile its own political problems except at the price of killing someone else. And I think one should be very straightforward about this because, of course, people died as a result of those missile strikes. And one has to worry that if Mr. Trump gets into more political difficulties further along the line, which I think he will, when you run an administration that is looking as dysfunctional as this one is at the moment, then, of course, the temptation to do more in order to get more good publicity is going to become extremely strong. And once you're into this kind of game of launching missile strikes in one direction, it's very difficult to stop. So I'm afraid, I think that President Trump has put himself in a more dangerous position than I think perhaps even he realizes. And one can't be optimistic about this.
Yeah, and Brian, if I could jump in here, is that I think it's even more multifaceted than this, is that not only has Trump limited his options, he may have painted himself into a corner. Maybe the next week, 2 weeks, will tell us that one way or another. But what I think is even more interesting is that because he's getting praise from his foes, I think Trump will be lulled into believing that, okay, he may lose part of his base because of this. This is the biggest flip-flop in my lifetime for a major politician when you're coming into office, just saying I'm going to completely reverse. Is that I think the knives will continue to be out and they will turn this into his war. Syria is now my responsibility. I think you and all three of us have been watching this horrific civil war play out over the last 6 years, that there is no simple solution. And its failure will be Trump's failure, and it will be used against him for being a failure. He didn't make America great again. Because as you point out, which is I think is a very sad testament, the only way America can be great again is to go to war with a country that never attacked it, where Syria is of no geopolitical interest. It's not a vital interest to the United States, like most of the world, I would argue. So I think that not only is he being lulled into some kind of safety zone, a safe place for him, I think what they're doing is they're putting him into a place where they'll be able to completely annihilate him. I'm sorry, because I do not see these neocons embracing Donald Trump.
Alexander, when I looked at the polls about the Syrian airstrikes, I was looking at them just yesterday. About 90% of the Republicans were all right with them. They either approved or approved greatly. It was about 10%, maybe 12% of Republicans that would be part of Trump's base disapproved of them strongly. And that's that wing of the Republican Party. But in other words, Trump isn't alienating a big part of the Republican Party. The Democratic approval rating, it wasn't an approval rating, but almost half of the Democrats supported the strikes, which is profound given the level of Democratic opposition to Trump. And as Peter is saying, and as I also commented, Trump now learns this is the formula for getting support. In other words, no matter how stupid it is, how reckless, how illegal, how immoral, how without substantiation or evidence, it just works politically. And the thing that Peter was mentioning was about how there's so many failures, and maybe you were mentioning too, and such sort of limited sort of thought, short-sightedness on the part of policymakers. This didn't just start. I mean, if you look back at the last almost 70 years, I mean, starting with the Korean War, the decision to go for it in North Korea, which ended in a disaster, the Vietnam War, Iraq in 2003, I mean, the U.S. is still there, and Afghanistan still there. I mean, the U.S. succeeded in crushing Grenada. That was a big one, 250,000 people. They succeeded in crushing Panama. But short of that, there haven't been a lot of great successes on the battlefield for the U.S., but there's just no accountability, so that just keeps happening over and over again. 1 minute. Go ahead.
Well, the quick thing to say about this is that, of course, Peter's absolutely right. Initially, there is a huge boost of support for the president in these situations. People thrilled at this sort of thing in the United States, which is a worrying thing. However, over time, if it all goes wrong, which it invariably does, the president is the person who gets blamed. That happened to Lyndon Johnson over Vietnam, and it happened to George W. Bush over Iraq. And it's very easy to see how President Trump could find himself in the same position. And, of course, the 12% of Republicans who are upset by this matter, maybe a small group within the Republican Party, they're also amongst the most articulate and vocal, and I would say intelligent part of the Republican Party. So he has lost them, and I think he's probably lost them completely. Lots of Democrats will oppose him regardless of what he does, because he is President Trump, he's right-wing, he's all those things. So it is very easy to see how over time, if he becomes the war president, the American people could turn against him. It happened to Lyndon Johnson. It happened to George W. Bush. I can very easily see how it might happen to Donald Trump.
That's the voice of Alexander Mercuris, the editor-in-chief of The Duran. We're also speaking from Moscow with Peter Lavelle. He is, of course, the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrived yesterday in Moscow. Today he has talks with the Foreign Minister Lavrov. We're speaking with Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk, in Moscow, and from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Peter, during our first segment, we talked a little bit about who's running the ship in Washington, or is there someone running the ship? Well, of course, the Trump cabinet is pretty filled up with generals. You have General McMaster, General Mattis, General Kelly. I want to quote to you something that's in the New York Times from General McMaster, and he's talking about what the cruise missile strikes on Syria mean or might not mean for the U.S. policy in Syria. Here's what he says. What's significant about the strike is not that it was meant to take out the Syrian regime's capacity or ability to commit mass murder of its own people, but it was to be a very strong signal to Assad and his sponsors that the United States cannot stand idly by as he is murdering innocent civilians. I mean, that seemed a bit contradictory to me. What do you think it means for U.S. policy in Syria? Are we going back to the Assad must go? Is it sort of between Tillerson and McMaster, not discounting Nikki Haley, who says, yes, regime change is the plan. I agree with Alexander. She's running for president in 2020 right now. What do you think, based on Tillerson and McMaster's statements?
I don't think they got on a conference call yet, okay? I'm convinced right now that they really don't know. It's really interesting. They don't know what to do. But you know, Brian, something must be done. This is about as advanced and mature as it has gotten. I mean, this goes all the way back to 2003. Something must be done about weapons of mass destruction. And that's the phrase we have heard ever since. They think something, they deeply feel something must be done, but they're not sure what it is. What's problematic here is that looking at the resumes of all the generals that you mentioned, Nikki Haley's resume, just throw it away. It's not worth anything when it comes to international relations. It is troublesome is that these people are trained and have careers in how to execute policy, but they do not have long careers and sophistication in policy creation and defining goals. And another thing is, with this boiling crisis, is that we know that Donald Trump has actually loosened the reins on his military underlings to do what they think is necessary to do. Thousands and thousands of troops have been taken to Kuwait, and they're on ready alert to be used when necessary, where they need to be done. And that's not going to be a decision by the president of the United States. So unless this is a very cleverly designed plan, which I doubt, we have a lot of major unknowns right now. And I think that's very troublesome because you're not just dealing with Syria. Syria is a medium-sized country for the Middle East. Its military now is pretty well honed. But when the generals are thinking about what to do and to tell the president of the United States, all those generals have to take in consideration what Russia will do. And one of the most galling elements of the discourse on this crisis is that other countries and other players have red lines, too, and they better find out what they are. And if they don't, I am very, and I'll say it on your program, I am deeply pessimistic moving forward.
Alexander, it seems to me that there is an ongoing and has been an ongoing cleavage within the U.S. political decision-making establishment, and it started even before Trump. It started during Obama's tenure. Obama had a schizophrenic policy towards Syria. At first, sort of with wind in their sails after the destruction of the Libyan government, the U.S. figured Assad would go quickly, so they just said Assad must go, Assad must go. That was during their Hillary Clinton State Department period. Obama seemed to be a bit reluctant about all of that, but sort of echoed it, but then had a restrained position. And then once it was clear that, especially after Russia intervened decisively on the side of the Syrian government and said that the Syrian government was indispensable to the outcome, including the defeat of ISIS, made it clear that Assad wasn't going to be overthrown. And then the Obama administration said, okay, let's start negotiations. And then Kerry came to Moscow. I mean, I don't know. You guys would know, like, zillions of times. Lots of negotiations. And then there was an agreement back in September that there would be a ceasefire, that there would be a peace process, that Russia and the United States at long last seemed to be on the same page. But Ash Carter and uniformed officers of the Pentagon actually said, we're not so sure. Well, Ash Carter argued against the agreement but lost that little sort of go-round. The Pentagon said, we're not so sure, meaning whether they were going to actually implement the ceasefire. And then they immediately struck Syrian army fixed positions, positions that had been fixed for some time. In other words, not a fluid situation where it was going back and forth between Syria and the armed opposition. And that was the end of the agreement. And then, in other words, the point is the Pentagon didn't want a ceasefire then, even though Obama, by that point, had seemed to opt for it, even if with timidity. Go ahead.
I think one of the key point to make about this is that, of course, the United States, or I think the prevailing view within the United States political and military establishment, is that they wanted President Assad to go ever since 2011. And when it became clear that he was not going to go without intervention from the United States, that intervention slowly and steadily picked up, and we had support provided to various people who are fighting him in Syria, with the U.S. looking away at the kind of people they were. What has changed the situation radically is that, of course, in September 2015, the Russians weren't there. And I think it's very clear that in spite of all the bravado that comes out of Washington from time to time, the US doesn't really want to fight the Russians in Syria. So that is why you get all these very complicated negotiations that happened all during 2016 with Kerry going to Moscow, Kerry meeting Lavrov, all these sort of discussions to try and find a way of getting rid of Assad without actually having to fight the Russians at the same time. And what the US has found is that the Russians are not prepared to play that kind of game. And that's why we have a situation which continues now, which remains, in a sense, intractable. Now, the problem is, many of us had started to think, or perhaps a more correct way to say, had started to hope that the US was finally drawing back, that it was accepting the reality that President Assad wasn't going anywhere, that the Russians were there in Syria, and that the US wasn't going to fight them, and that it was starting to work towards a more realistic outcome in Syria. What has happened over the last week has now put all that once again in flux. We don't really know what the policy is in the US. It still seems that there is reluctance to take the Russians on head on. And what we're seeing instead are various attempts to press the Russians or bully them or intimidate them or bribe them to try and change their position with respect to President Assad, which is something they have consistently refused to do and which I am sure they will continue to do. So instead of moving forward towards a more realistic position, which Peter Lavelle was talking about before, I'm afraid we're going to be back into the kind of situation of growing friction, constant shadow boxing around Syria, various attempts to launch missile strikes, do various things, but never really solve the problem, which just goes on and on with more people dying, more suffering, and more war.
We shouldn't really be surprised in a way, because if you look at Hillary Clinton lost the campaign because of Russian meddling, because of that false narrative here that is just overwhelming in American media, wall-to-wall 24/7. And then when you get to – and that's all internally driven. But when you get to a foreign policy crisis in which Russia is involved in legally, we have to remind our listeners, then everything starts to short circuit, because – Russia is the enemy. How can we deal with the enemy? How can we trust them in all this? And what they've done is this hysteria that has overtaken media narrative in the United States. See how it works against it? Works against how to use a coherent foreign policy? Russia is a very rational actor if you look at what it does. Assad is a very, I came across a couple of articles. He's so diabolical that he would use chemical weapons just to spit in Trump's face. That's how evil he is. No, he's a very rational person. You don't have to like him or what he's done in the past, but he has survived. And that's one thing that these policymakers should understand is survival. It is existential. So common sense has to be used. Not all of this bravado that we've heard from Washington in the internal political discussion.
I want to ask you both, I want you and Alexander to both respond to it, because I think it's extremely instructive for our audience when we're trying to understand how Trump, who has been really campaigning on the idea that the United States should have better relations with Russia, that the United States should not be the policeman of the world. And that was resonating with parts of the population. And if a Democrat had said it, the Democratic base would have certainly resonated with them, too, because, of course, the American people don't want to be the policeman of the world. They don't want to be in endless war. But let's just go back into some history. This isn't the first time we've seen like a dramatic turnaround like this between a candidate's foreign policy orientation on the campaign trail versus after they've taken office. And I want to read to both of you a remarkable exchange between Al Gore and George W. Bush in a debate right before the 2000 election. And for our younger listeners, this is going to be shocking to them. But here it is, Al Gore, Democrat. Like it or not, the United States is now the natural leader of the world. All of the other countries are looking to us. Now, just because we cannot be involved everywhere and shouldn't be, doesn't mean that we should shy away from going in anywhere. Bush responds, George W. Bush, then Canada responds, I am not so sure the role of the United States is to go around the world and say this is the way it's got to be. We can help, and maybe it's just our difference in government, the way we view government. I just don't think it's the role of the United States to walk into a country and say, we do it this way, so should you. In other words, he's telling the electorate at that time, we shouldn't be the policemen of the world. That was George W. Bush, who a year later is invading Afghanistan, going to war in Iraq. And of course, there's no connection at all to September 11th. In other words, is it institutional that the United States is going to play the role of policeman in the world, regardless of who the person is who's running for office?
I've said this many times on Crosstalk, and it's a question, in my mind, it's a rhetorical question, but I do ask it of my guests, and is this the genetic code of American foreign policy, irrespective of the occupant in the White House? And I think the answer is obviously yes. We saw, you know, we can go through the intricacies about how Bush was converted, but it's very obvious what happened to Trump. I mean, he came in with a certain agenda, and basically, okay, they're going to start picking off Flynn, Nunes, going after his attorney general. I mean, it was a turkey shoot, and I think, you know, Trump got the message. He said, okay, all right, got the message here. What is worrisome, Brian? I encourage our listeners to listen and watch a film that's on YouTube. It's called Path to War. And it's about how Lyndon Johnson saw his domestic agenda crushed because of the war in Vietnam, a war that he was very hesitant to get into. But because of what you just said, he was cajoled, forced, pushed into a war by the, what I think is a good term, the deep state. So I think you're right.
So, Alexander, same thing. I want to just throw into this before you respond.
I agree with Peter about this. I mean, it is the default position of every president. The problems of going in a different direction are so enormous. The resistance is so strong that they eventually find that it simply isn't worth it. And they always, in the end, take the line of least resistance, which is do what the foreign policy, the defense, the intelligence establishment, the news media, Congress, all expect them to. But the problem with doing it, and we've already touched on it, is that when things go wrong, and they invariably do, there is a political price to pay, and the person who pays the price is the president himself. In Donald Trump's case, I think this process will happen much more quickly than it had with either Lyndon Johnson or George W. Bush, simply because he is so obviously the political outsider, and they will turn on him very quickly indeed, in my opinion.
Or they may be embracing him, because even if things go badly for the people, say, in Syria, if, like I think one of you was saying earlier, oh, about the sanctions, like the Americans don't feel these things. In other words, there's a shield, economic sanctions, wars abroad, drone strikes. It's not actually impacting people here. I mean, if people were impacted here, if Americans were, say, dying in a Syrian war, then again, we'd have this a massive anti-war movement. But right now, what Trump is learning, seems to me, is just do these things. It's going to be a disaster for other people. Sanctions like in Russia, against Russia, bad for farmers in Europe, but not farmers in the United States. And you'll get a lot of political applause. The unity between Democrats and Republicans, the so-called bipartisan unity, will be achieved again. Peter, we have 60 seconds. You go ahead.
It gets down to American exceptionalism in the world. And you know, I have to, because of my job, and like you do, Brian, I have to watch all media, television and print. And this, the level of hubris, and we've already touched upon it in this program. You know, the United States is a deeply, deeply divided country right now. The election showed that. And it's really quite sad when Brian Williams on MSNBC with a guest and looking at the missiles being fired from American warships in the Mediterranean and say how beautiful they are, how wonderful they are, praising this technology. And I think that is really a point of a really great, and I'll say it, moral decay. And it's because of the grasp and looking at empire as something that is something good for the United States and the American.
That's Peter Lavelle. We're talking to him from Moscow. We're talking to Alexander Mercuris from London. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Moscow today for talks with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We're joined for the full hour from Moscow by Peter Lavelle, host of RT's flagship program Crosstalk, and from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. Peter Lavelle, you were talking before we went to break about these sort of odious, shameless presentation about the beauty of cruise missiles. Raytheon, who makes cruise missiles, they were very excited that the mass media was loving Tomahawk cruise missiles because it sent their stocks up. I mean, we have an incentivizing system for war. In other words, violence is good business. You know, when we go out and have demonstrations here against war, the police and the media always say, are you going to be violent? Well, you know, we never are violent, but this is a very, very violent government. Go ahead.
And it's really interesting. Are you going to be violent protesting violence? Yes, the President Eisenhower coined it for us, the military-industrial complex. It's very, very real. And when the Cold War ended, how do you justify all these budgets? How do you justify these numbers of troops? How about R&D to keep up with the future and all this? And they, one of my favorite phrases is that, you know, it's a foreign policy of hammers in search of nails, searching for nails. And, you know, we have political figures in the United States saying that we have the right to intervene anywhere in the world because of oppression and suffering. I mean, no one's talking about, you know, intervening and ending the conflict in Yemen. Most people don't even really know about that conflict. So, yes, it's institutionally built in. I mean, yes, if you had invested in Raytheon in 2000, you earned multiples of your original investment. You know, what, you know, war's good for your portfolio. But, of course, in my mind, you know, when I look at the United States, this money needs to be spent at home because we had this election in 2016, and there are real deep social problems that have to be dealt with. And that kind of expenditure is sexy. You can't sell it, you know. I mean, Brian Williams, he's a salesman for imperialism in foreign wars. And you know what? He's pretty good at it.
Yes, it's amazing. The United States is always described as the richest country in the world, but the people in the United States are not the richest people in the world. In matter of fact, one out of every two Americans lives either in poverty or near poverty. 30 million can't go to a doctor still when they're sick or can't take their kids when they're sick. I mean, these are not indices of wealth. They're indices of poverty. And yet, Alexander, Trump is promising a $54 billion increase in the defense budget. Now, just to put that into perspective, and maybe you can help the audience compare it, say, to Russia or to China's military budget, but the Americans are told Syria is a danger, North Korea is a danger, Russia's a danger. Well, a $54 billion increase in Pentagon spending for the next fiscal year, well, that's 11 times greater than what the North Koreans say spend in the entire year. They only spend $4 billion on military armaments. We're told North Korea is threatening America, but the United States really spends almost $1 trillion when you look at all the different departments in which defense spending is increased. Talk about how the logic of spending also creates its own political logic in terms of foreign policy.
If we're talking about the spending, the fact that the United States spends so much more on defense or on its military than so many other countries put together. I mean, I think it's the other five top countries put together is a clear sign that it is not those countries that are threatening the United States. It is the United States which is threatening them. And, of course, Peter, I think, put his finger on the dynamic. It was actually said very plainly by Madeleine Albright when she was Secretary of State, when she said, what's the point of having this marvelous military if you don't use it? And that's, I think, always the temptation that the U.S. has. It finds it impossible in the end to resist because it can launch missiles in all sorts of places, send warships to near North Korea, as it is presently doing, intervene in Iraq, intimidate countries in Latin America. It does them. And because this is such a profitable activity, there is always a very strong business lobby that promotes it, because it is always an exciting thing. The media likes it, and it sells more newspapers, because politicians win more support by doing it. They all do it. And we get into this very dangerous cycle. In the meantime, as you absolutely rightly say, the actual problems of the United States are mounting. And they have been doing so for decades. We have a country that is now heavily in debt, and yet it is spending more on its military, which is not a good way to create wealth. It is finding itself in conflicts with all sorts of people all over the world, where what it really wants, what it really needs, is a period of peace to sort out its problems. But the temptation to go to war, to take a belligerent line, to strut, if one wishes, along the world stage, is always too strong. And the political system of the United States makes it very difficult to resist that.
Peter, Prime Minister Medvedev said that the U.S., quote, was, quote, on the edge of military clashes with Russia, close quote. I mean, pretty dramatic statement. The timing of the cruise missile strike was also interesting because it was at the very moment on the first day of the visit of Xi Jinping from China. They were having dinner together with Trump, and at the end of it, and Trump is obviously putting China's pressure on North Korea on the agenda. He says, oh, we just, you know, we struck Syria, a country that the Chinese have a friendly relationship with. I mean, it's pretty dramatic when you look at the whole thing. You're in Moscow. Is there a feeling that that Russia and America are on the edge of clashes, or is that a bit sort of overstated?
I think it's overstated, but only at this point here. So many things that we've talked about together, the three of us, there's so many unknowns out there, and it's very difficult to coherently put things together and make some kind of prognosis. When I think of Xi sitting next to Donald Trump, I have to think that what I could read his mind by saying that, is this man out of his mind? He said one thing a few weeks ago, then on the campaign, and now he's doing this. See, the problem is that if the imperial advance of the United States halts, then there's a perception it will start declining. And when it declines rapidly. At least that's the mindset of the elites here. It's very much like the end of the Roman Empire. They had debts. They had all kinds of social problems. And so what did they give them? Bread and circuses. Empire is the circus. You're right, Brian. Half the country is poor. But look at those beautiful missiles. And I think the Chinese are looking at this. What? The Americans are going to start what? Another war? Again? Over this? Didn't we see that Colin Powell do this already? Don't you know what the results were? I think the Chinese must be mystified that the American Imperium is going to try it again. I mean, how many times do you have to go up to bat to realize you shouldn't be playing this game?
Indeed. You know, it seems to me that I don't believe we're on the edge of a clash, but I do believe when you look at the trajectory of things, both under Bush, under Obama, now under Trump, the sort of the continuity of trajectory, you can see that there is in the sort of mad fantasy that the U.S. could become the unipolar power in the world and thus sort of snuff out any competition anywhere and relying mainly on military, not economic means for that purpose. We've entered a period where there is not international equilibrium. Like even the dangerous Cold War, the standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, there was symmetry, there was equilibrium at a certain point. Even though the Soviet Union wasn't as great of a military power and certainly not as great of an economic power, it had allies, it had nuclear weapons. There was equilibrium, and that equilibrium provided a framework for peace agreements, for nuclear arms talks, all kinds of sort of internationally agreed upon frameworks. It seems to me, Alexander, that we've entered a sort of a post-equilibrium world, or maybe back the way it was, you know, 100 years ago, you know, when before World War I or World War II, where the absence of equilibrium between major powers makes it even more toxic.
I think that we should perhaps revise our view of the Cold War and stop referring it as the Cold War, and perhaps more properly as the Cold Peace. Because in a sense, for much of the world, that is what it was. I mean, certainly conflicts happened. We talked about Korea, we talked about Vietnam, but it was always possible to contain them and to operate them within an overall framework of international relations. What has happened is that when the Cold War structures disintegrated in the late 1980s and early 1990s, nothing effective was put in their place. And the United States, wildly overestimating the opportunity that this window created, has, in a sense, gone for broke. It thinks that it has untrammeled power to do what it pleases. It doesn't. There isn't such a thing. International relations has never worked that way. And the risk is not, I think, that we will return to a kind of 19th century type system, because actually, in some ways, that was also quite a stable system. The greater danger is that we will end up in an early 20th century type of system, where you have certain countries, Germany, both pre-World War I, pre-World War II Germany, Japan, countries with very overambitious foreign policies, becoming increasingly detached from reality, overestimating their power, overestimating their opportunities, and in the end, miscalculating disastrously and doing terrible things along the way. I don't think we're quite there yet with the United States, and I hope we never get there, but I think there is a certain danger of it, and I think that is the thing that people must speak out against.
Go ahead, Peter. Same question. It seems to me that the Russian government and the Chinese government are carrying out what amounts to an exceptionally prudent and cautious policy. In other words, not inflamed responses at all. I think they're worried, and they don't want to poke the beast because they know the beast is a beast. Go ahead.
Well, it's very interesting. Maybe on the second side of the coin with what Alexander Mikiris was saying, the unipolar moment is coming to an end, and they know it. They know it. That's why it seems very interesting to me is that you see a very activist foreign policy without a steward at the top, because we still have no clear idea how involved President Trump is in foreign policy right now. Look at the exercises in South Korea, all of the saber rattling with the South China Sea. We haven't mentioned a very important country in all of this, Iran. With Syria is where I think, and again, you know, these plans never work out. I call it the law of unintended consequences. There are people in Washington that think this is a gambit to humiliate and punish the Russians and to shut out the Iranians, which is illusory. My goodness. And to your point, Brian, I think you're absolutely right. When you look at the sobriety that comes is coming out of Beijing and in Moscow, if people used to say, you know, is China dangerous, a rising China, like we saw with Japan and Germany, that we're not given a fair place in the international order, that's why we had conflict. Then they're talking about, well, will China's rise be peaceful? We should be asking a very different question. Will the United States' descent be peaceful? And this is what we're seeing. It's not peaceful. This unipolar moment that was so coveted and people were so proud about, it's coming to an end. And I think they're throwing the dice, hoping for boxcars, but I think they're going to get snake eyes.
Alexander, we have about 3 minutes left. Peter had mentioned earlier, I believe, that the point that Trump has loosened the reins, or maybe it was you, one of you, loosened the reins on the military. The military doesn't have to get permission now to send additional and deploy additional troops. It can intervene in battles closer into the front lines. Clearly, there's 6,000 troops in Iraq, perhaps more private contractors, a growing contingent in Syria. The United States has dispatched strike force towards North Korea. Korea says right now they're preparing for a serious phase. It's not a hyperbolic statement. I mean, not one of those like bombastic North Korean statements. This was a statement, we're entering a serious phase. I mean, in other words, if there's nobody running the ship and the military is giving all of this free rein and they're not long-term thinkers and we're seeing an empire in decline, it seems to me to be the kind of situation, without trying to be alarmist, that the people of the world must be taking into account in the most serious way. It is a serious phase.
It is extremely serious because, of course, it also means that if the military are running the show and they're doing so in all sorts of places without necessarily going back to Washington, and it was Peter who pointed that out, and it's true, then, of course, what is the point of negotiating with Washington? Because local military commanders are taking more and more initiative into their own hands. And Peter's also absolutely right. These people are not trained political thinkers. They don't operate within overarching strategies. They see the tactical situation as they judge it at the time. So we have situations where, who knows, a military officer might find himself under some sort of pressure and might decide to escalate without referring back to Washington. And, of course, that could create all sorts of dangers. It very nearly happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And, of course, it's entirely possible that it might happen again.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, it is a serious time. We're talking with Peter Lavelle from Moscow. He is the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. We've been talking from London with Alexander Mercuris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. We're talking about what is coming next. Peter, in the last 30 seconds or so, what do you think? You have Tillerson in Moscow. Anything going to come out of this?
No, but I think that Tillerson is going to learn something from Sergei Lavrov. Lavrov had to teach John Kerry for the entire time they worked together on how to build a ceasefire and a peace process in Syria. It always was the Russian initiative. My only hope is that Rex Tillerson will listen and see that there is no panic in Russia. There is disappointment. There's frustration. But I'll tell you, and our listeners have to know, Russia is always, always open to a deal, a fair deal. That's what's going to be most important. Will Rex Tillerson understand that and bring that back to Washington? We'll all have to wait to see.
Okay, that's Peter Lavelle. We've also been talking with Alexander Mercuris. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.